when a patient goes into cardiac arrest, you don't get the group together to perform whatever they're capable of performing. You simply leave the patient alone, had a heart attack, call the Chevra Kedishva, and get it all over with. And the question was, do you ever have a right not to call these people to do what they're capable of doing? Let me say this. I think that if you have a 95-year-old patient who has terminal cancer, metastasis to all vital organs, and he's already had two cardiac arrests, and he's now got the third one, that you don't code him.
Why is that?
I'll explain. Short of that, I'm not terribly certain that there are very many situations which you can use a no-code. Now, I've been extreme, obviously. Let me try to explain. In general, there is an obligation to treat every patient regardless of the quality of life that that patient can anticipate. There's one exception, at least one basic exception, a possible exception, and that's a geusis. A geusis. Gimel, vav, samach, samach. What's a geusis? A geusis is not a moribund patient, or let's put it this way, not all moribund patients are geusisim. There is no English term that coincides with the class of geusisim. A geusis A is a patient who has lost control of all bodily functions, including inability to swallow or to bring up saliva. B, in my humble opinion, a patient who, despite whatever therapy will be applied, will not survive for 72 hours. Now, what about a geusis?
Could you elaborate on the 72 hours? Does that mean by himself or including codes?
No matter
codes?
What you do, for, including treatment, including codes.
You could have to do a code on him every hour for the next 72 hours, but as
fine.
Long as...
Okay. Right, if you could do a code every hour on the hour, and you would each time survive for 72 more codes, you'd have to do it.
Then he's not a geusis.
He's not a geusis, by definition. Now, halacha says that if a patient is a geusis, he isn't supposed to be moved, let alone manipulated the way you manipulate in the course of resuscitation. Because a patient who is in this state is in the process of dying, and if you move the patient, you are likely to cause him to die sooner than he would have died otherwise. A patient who is a geusis is alive. Mechal Shabbos for him, do whatever you can to prolong his life, but you don't hasten his death. Movement can hasten death, so that every time you move him, you are in effect endangering his life, and you have a right to do that only if you can prolong his life in the process. Now, a patient who's gone to cardiac arrest may not be dead in halacha. If there has been a cessation of cardiac and respiratory activity, which is irreversible in nature, then the patient is dead. If it's reversible in nature, the patient is not dead. But even if it's reversible, he may be a geusis, which means that if you aren't successful in resuscitating, you may be killing him. Therefore, you in effect are you've got a life in your hands. You're either an angel of mercy and you're being mekayim all kinds of mitzvahs, or you are unknowingly committing an act of homicide. And every doctor does that, and that's a terrible achrayus, but doctors have to do that. A doctor has a right to commit homicide. Unwittingly, if he does it in good conscience, and he's well-trained, and he's applied general accepted standards of care, and he's been vigilant, and he's done what he's supposed to do, then he's fine. He's doing exactly what the Rebbeinu Shlomo wants him to do. The expression in Halach is that Shigas Reifes Kavonos Abayrim. When the doctor makes a mistake, that's what the Rebbeinu Shlomo wanted in the first place. But the doctor has to use his judgment in making that determination. Now, if you've got a patient and you are convinced, medically convinced, that the majority of patients presenting this clinical profile are resuscitable and they will survive beyond the period of cessa, then you have an obligation to resuscitate. If, in your professional opinion, the majority of such patients will not be resuscitable, then you have no business touching the patient. Now, that sounds very glib. And in the real world, it's a very difficult kind of decision to make, but you've got to make those decisions. And that's what the people are doctors for. And the only criteria are medical criteria, nothing else. And the fact that the patient's got terminal cancer and everybody would be a lot happier if he died is not a medical consideration, it's a human consideration. and one that shouldn't be swept under the carpet, but that's got nothing to do with medicine. The only determination that you're called upon to make is in terms of the medical profile of the patient. Is this patient a candidate for resuscitation, or is he not a candidate for resuscitation? So that going back to the question, can you ever put a no code on a patient? Sure. How often? Cases are few and far between. Most patients should be resuscitated. There are some patients who should not be resuscitated. There are others that are gray areas.
How did your patient with the terminal cancer become a geisus?
Well, I suspected that this patient is so weak and physically deteriorated, and given the history of two cardiac arrests already, I presumed that this patient would not survive another active resuscitation. Therefore, I don't think he should be coded.
Okay,
now, if you disagree on the medical facts, by all means, resuscitate.
If the doctor's not sure?
If the doctor is not sure, he has to ask himself, what does he think would be the case with regard to about 50% of such patients in this clinical state? If he's still not sure, he should resuscitate.
Now, does the nurse have the right to do this, or does she have to go by the previous doctor's orders, even if she thinks he didn't take these considerations into account?
I think that the nurse should resuscitate if she is convinced that the patient is resuscitable.
Will this depend on whether the patient is Jewish or not?
Yes. I think in the case of a Jewish patient, she has an absolute obligation. In the case of a non-Jewish patient, I don't think she has an absolute obligation. Going back to what I said last time, I certainly don't think that she should announce that she resuscitates her Jewish patients and doesn't resuscitate her non-Jewish patients. But I do think that since this is a clinical judgment which is very much ad hoc, she ought to be discreet enough to be able to distinguish and to call some strikes and others balls. But for that, you have to have seichel.
Yitzchak.
Does a patient have a right to make a choice?
No.
This is not. He has no rights?
That brings us to one of the questions, the patient, what do we do with the living will?
A patient doesn't have a right to refuse treatment when that treatment is necessary to prolong life, and when the treatment is, by definition, not hazardous. Now, conceivably, if you're dealing with a cardiac arrest and the patient says, I know that there is danger that after I go into arrest, the minimal life that I have left to me in the state of cardiac arrest will be snuffed out by the procedure, and therefore I don't want you to resuscitate because I don't want to take that risk, that probably would be justifiable. However, it's justifiable only if that's what the patient is saying. The patient is saying, I don't want the risk. I don't think there are very many patients who say, I don't want the risk associated with moving a geisus. What they're saying is, I don't want to live. That's to be ignored totally and completely. The fact that the patient doesn't want to live is not something that should influence the doctor.
Rabbi Fein.
Yeah.
Does the pain of a patient in such a type of a case matter? He has a terrible pain, mm-hmm. and a chance of going to live are very, very slim. Mm-hmm. And he would wish to die rather than to suffer. Okay.
All right. Bottom line, I don't think that's a consideration for two reasons. A, I'm not convinced that it's intrinsically a consideration. B, pain it can be controlled. It's not always convenient to control pain, but there is virtually no medical condition that produces pain that's intractable. Sometimes you may have to use increasingly large doses of morphine to control pain, and it may be necessary to use heroin to control pain. I know, I mean, a lot of things I don't understand, but I know why the Rabbi Shlomo created morphine. I'm sorry, why he created heroin, and I know why he created marijuana. He created marijuana to alleviate the side effects of chemotherapy, and he created heroin for terminal cancer patients. Only we're too stupid to use it where it should be used. And we sell it on the street to all kinds of people who don't need it, and people in hospital who should be getting it don't get it. I have no objection to civil disobedience in good causes. I would have no hesitation to prescribe heroin to a patient and to dare the district attorney to do something about it. Now, in point of fact, you don't have to use heroin. You could use morphine. The problem with morphine is that you need good nursing care, because if you give it on demand, chances are that in a relatively short period of time, you'll be giving doses which will suppress the respiratory centers, and the patient will have to be put on a respirator. So put the patient on a respirator. You'll have to monitor the patient, make sure he doesn't go under, but then provide adequate nursing care. You can control pain, and you should be controlling pain, and society should be more concerned about controlling pain than in formulating guidelines for when you can withhold treatment because the patient is in pain. Yet, having said all of that, there might be grounds, and I say it very tentatively, there might be grounds for withholding treatment at a patient's request when the pain is so severe that the patient would spend all his money, even if he were Rockefeller, in order to alleviate the pain. In other words, what I'm saying is that with regard to every mitzvah has a limit. There are certain lengths to which you have to go to fulfill mitzvah, and beyond that, you're not obligated. In terms even of the lav, negative prohibitions, there it's kol mamayna. A person has to spend every penny he has. If that's the only way you can prevent somebody from taking a gun and telling him to eat a ham sandwich. If the guy will take the gun away, if I give him my entire bank account, I have to give him my bank account. But I don't have to borrow money. I just have to give my bank account. More than I have, I don't have to sign an IOU for anything beyond the bank account. Now, there are some things that Achronim speak of as being more than kol mamayna. It's more than the person's entire fortune. There is the Sheet Mekubetzis and Ksubis in one place talks about, in one region, others disagree there in context, talk about intractable pain or torture as being something beyond that which an individual has to assume in order not to commit an aver, not to transgress. It may be that somebody could argue that pain, which is so severe that a person would give away every penny that he has to eliminate the pain, is more than kol mamayna. Therefore, he has no obligation of v'samin adam riecho, he has no obligation of pikuach nefesh, he doesn't have to save a life, not even his own life, and therefore could refuse to accept treatment legitimately under those circumstances. That argument, if somebody made it, would be cogent. Yet I'm not convinced that's normative halacha. I'm not convinced that's the bottom line. I certainly don't believe that the vast majority of cases that are presented as being cases involving severe pain qualify under that general category. And as a general principle, I would say, do everything you can to eliminate pain, except withholding life support systems that are necessary to preserve life. In other words, what the bottom line is that I don't think you should withhold treatment because a patient is in pain. Turn your mind and attention to what you can do to alleviate the pain instead. I think that should be the general rule.
Even if the terms of life are very slim, and even if it's going to survive, we just have a very short period of time.
You see, now you've complicated it again. He will survive for a very short period of time. Now you're going back to a Geisa situation. And the
it's
question
not a Geisa yet, but...
You mean he'll survive for a couple of weeks. Yeah, by all means, treat.
Dr. Dawa?
Yeah, but that's a big expense on the part of the patient and also the part of the relatives and everything else.
And
another big problem here.
So,
when the patient's going to go anyway in a very, very short time,
right.
you're talking about thousands and thousands of dollars that you're going to have to spend for just a few weeks of nothing.
So, right? I mean, look, do we have dollar values on human life?
In this case, I think so, yes.
I disagree.
Where there's absolutely no chance whatsoever of the patient surviving or leaving that hospital alive.
I strongly disagree. Yes?
In the state of California, mm-hmm. in order to perform certain procedures,
mm-hmm.
one has to have a signed
consent. Right.
In the area of chronic renal disease, as you know, life-saving measures include hemodialysis.
Right.
What happens in a situation where a patient with chronic renal disease refuses to continue hemodialysis?
Mm-hmm.
What do you do?
Twist his arm. till he signs.
Pardon?
Twist his arm till he signs.
Supposing you twist his arm and his family's arm.
And they're still not signing. And they still refuse to sign.
Or if they, let's assume, I'll give you an actual situation.
Are they Jewish?
Family signs, patient signs, and after 2 weeks or 3 weeks say they want to discontinue treatment.
Mm-hmm.
No, but he doesn't have to come back.
No, you can't bring him bodily.
Right, bodily.
We can't bring him into the hospital.
Supposing he's in the hospital.
Yes.
Make it easier.
You're right. Yeah, sure, because he's not in the hospital, you know, there's nothing you can do physically.
If he doesn't come back, then you have a problem.
Right, if he's in the hospital. Yeah, he's in the hospital. You wonder what he's
doing. I'm giving you a hypothetical situation, I'm giving you an actual situation.
Of course, it happens all the time. It happens all the time. I think you should do everything in your power to institute hemodialysis. I'm assuming that there's no real danger associated with hemodialysis, even though I know very well there is some danger of hepatitis, blah, blah.
Right.
But I consider those to be so insignificant that they are not really dangers. However, if you disagree on the facts, then the answer would be different. If you think that hepatitis is a serious consideration, then you may not be obligated to force consent or to do anything. But I think that under contemporary conditions, that danger is so remote that it's equivalent to the danger of crossing the street outside. I do think that you're under an obligation to do everything possible to institute hemodialysis, certainly for a Jewish patient. Again, for a non-Jewish patient, I don't think that you have to be all that aggressive, but I think you should do everything that you can do to do the bail.
When you say not aggressive, are you permitted halakhically to write on the order sheet discontinued dialysis?
Oh, no. I don't think you should write
discontinued. I mean, if the patient and the family state unequivocally they want to have another treatment.
Right. I think under those circumstances, I would simply go ahead and do it. Again, that's we have enough problems with the medical questions without going to the legal ones. But unless you got a written, notarized statement ordering you to discontinue, you'd probably be covered if you kept on doing it. Again, I don't want to complicate it by introducing legal problems, but if you've got an original informed consent, I think you would probably be covered. You wouldn't have any problems. You certainly wouldn't be obligated to write discontinue on the order sheet.
Like we've talked about whom to resuscitate and not to resuscitate, the question comes up all the time among physicians as to on whom, if anybody, can the respirators be disconnected or not reconnected and so forth. There is a list of criteria that we formulated in this area, trying to incorporate the opinions of the various Paiskim, and I wondered what your opinion of them was. Would you like me to read them?
I can deal with them without having them read. Let me say this. You're asking, in effect, two distinct questions. A, for a definition of death. B, for a profile of a situation in which you can legitimately withhold treatment. Let me deal with the second first. If you have diagnosed a state of ecchesia, assuming that's possible, you've defined those terms already. You've diagnosed. I'm sorry. I used the term geusis before. You have already established that the patient is a geusis. Fine. Now the question is, what are you obligated to do? Here there is some difference of opinion. The Mishnah, no less an authority than the Mishnah Berurah, maintains that you have to use any standard medical procedure on a geusis, that you cannot withhold treatment from a geusis. Even though he's going to die anyway within 72 hours, but you have to prolong life within that 72-hour period insofar as possible. If somebody is chopping wood outside the door, it's clear that you have to stop chopping the wood so that he can die. What's the difference? This is a problem. There are Achronim who disagree with the Mishnah Berurah, and they maintain that you cannot kill a geusis, but you don't, and you should not, prolong the life of a geusis. stop chopping the wood outside if the noise is preventing him from dying in peace, and don't give him penicillin and aspirin. And to my mind, I see no difference between blood transfusions and aspirin. Don't give him transfusion. Don't give him IV. And if he's not on a respirator, don't put him on a respirator. I won't worry about pulling the plug, but certainly don't put him on the respirator. Don't do anything if he is a gaseous.
That's that opinion.
That's one opinion. Others maintain that you've got to do everything for a gaseous which does not endanger him. All non-invasive procedures, all procedures don't involve moving him. You've got to keep the IV, you've got to replenish the oxygen canister, and you've got to give whatever drugs you can, and to do everything possible to prolong life, including keeping him on a respirator or even putting him on a respirator in the first place.
Yes. Things that do involve moving, that do not involve moving?
I said particularly things that don't involve moving. When you're moving, then you've got to weigh the risk-benefit. So that for those authorities, it would be absolutely forbidden to remove a respirator or not to reattach the respirator, even if it's been removed for suctioning or whatever. Now, I have very little difficulty answering the question. I have little difficulty because, in my opinion, a gaseous should be treated. At least should be treated by non-invasive means which do not increase the risk of the gaseous. Reb Moshe is of a contrary opinion. Reb Moshe maintains that a gaseous should not be treated. Now, I'm not disagreeing with Reb Moshe. Reb Moshe is not disagreeing with me. I can show you Achronim going back for a period of 200 years. And I'm convinced that they are in the majority. And Reb Moshe has the right to disagree, but when I'm consulted by a doctor or by a family, I tell the doctor and the family to treat the gaseous as long as the treatment doesn't further endanger the patient. So that, to me, the question of pulling the plug or not pulling the plug is entirely academic, because if you pull it, you've got to put it back immediately. Now, you've got to treat the gaseous, but you don't treat cadavers. The next question is, when is the patient dead? And that's the determination of death question, the time of death. Now, here, Reb Moshe has been misquoted and misunderstood, although, in defense of the people who misquote him and misconstrue his position, I have to say that he lends himself to misunderstanding. Reb Moshe has repeatedly stated that brain death criteria are simply not acceptable under any shape, manner, form. Brain death is not death in halacha. There is absolutely nobody of any standing or stature whatsoever who accepts any definition of brain death that has been advanced by any responsible segment of the medical community. Now, let me amplify that a little bit. The people whom I have the most respect for are the members of the Harvard Committee. They never spoke about brain death. Beecher stated very clearly that the committee did not define death. The committee defined irreversible coma. For that, I give them a yasher koyach. They've given me information that doesn't help me. They've told me what is irreversible coma. Fine, now I know what irreversible coma is. Now, what does that mean? They would then say, if you're dealing with a case of irreversible coma, as the gentleman put it before, why spend thousands of dollars to maintain a patient in a state of irreversible coma? And by their lights, they're absolutely correct. When you talk in terms of halacha, the fact that the patient is in irreversible coma, you have conceded, doesn't mean that he's dead. If he's not dead, then he's alive. And the fact that the quality of life being sustained isn't terribly significant by some people's lights is totally irrelevant. I've got to treat this patient the way I treat everybody else. A patient in a state of irreversible coma is not even a gaseous. Karen Ann Quinlan is not a gaseous by anybody's definition. Therefore, the Harvard criteria as criteria of brain death are certainly unacceptable. The only type of brain death that is acceptable in halacha is decapitation.
Does that include...
A patient has been guillotined, the patient is dead regardless of whatever other symptoms are manifest, and for this I can even quote you a tshuva. There's a tshuva in the Shulchan Yankiv that defines this as death. Fine. If somebody will argue that total lysis of the brain, if the brain is now one big collection of liquid, that is tantamount to decapitation, I will perhaps buy it. I have written an article in Haparda saying that that is not decapitation, but okay, so what? Somebody can disagree. If total lysis exists, we'll accept that as being the equivalent of decapitation. There is absolutely no clinical test available that will indicate that lysis is total. In fact, respirator brain, the kind of brain that a pathologist examines on autopsy, that's a gooey, mushy lump, is by definition not a body which is totally liquefied. Some of the brain has turned into liquid, but there's other brain that's there, it's remaining. And unless and until the entire brain has been destroyed literally, not functionally, but until you've created an ayin miyesh, you took something that exists and made it non-existent, there is a brain there, and that is not not compatible with any definition of death in terms of halacha. What that then means is that even radioisotope techniques are not sufficient to establish a definition of death which is acceptable in halacha. I would add to that that even accepting a kind of radioisotope technique to establish brain death, by definition meaning that you have shown that there is no blood flow to the brain. And then you then argue that if you don't have blood flowing through the tissue can't live, and in effect you've got a dead brain. That's taking it one step beyond my concession earlier. Earlier I conceded that if the brain turns into water, then you've got a dead patient. Now we'll take the second step and say that if the tissue dies, even though it's there, it's also dead tissue. Even accept that. Clinically, there is no test that will show that there is no circulation to the brain. All that it shows is a deficit. It doesn't show that there's total and complete cessation of circulation. And even after you've established total and complete cessation of circulation, I don't know how long it takes for that tissue up there to die. It does take time. And you first have to tell me how long it takes, and then I have to buy some of these other arguments before I could accept that as a definition of brain death. Brain death criteria simply cannot be accepted by halacha, and Rav Moshe himself has stated that repeatedly. Every recognized pesach has stated exactly the same thing. I had an experience some time ago. It was a Chabad Rav who didn't know these things about brain death. You know, what does this mean? And in the course of the explanation, it was a little bit esoteric to him. He stopped from it and said, "Please, ain't zakhdu with this. I'm blake to a hand. Is called Savarin." If you put your hand on it, yeah, is there a warm body or isn't there a warm body?
This,
I don't mean you touch a patient who has been pronounced brain dead on the basis of these clinical criteria, the body's warm for the touch. Now, that's not a halakhic criterion by any means, but it's good elementary seichel. If you've got a warm body, the body's alive.
So you would agree with that's what Rabbi Jaworkin asked.
Yes. Rabbi Dworkin was the individual who asked whether the body's alive.
Well, I was very impressed with because it summarizes a lot of biophysics, biochemistry.
Yes, he's right.
You know,
yeah,
he neurophysiology.
Rabbi Dworkin certainly didn't mean to imply that was the halachic criterion of life, but it's a very good rule of thumb, and it works. The bottom line is right. The reasoning may not be hard and fast, but if you've got a warm body, you've got a live body.
Well, I would like to mention to the doctors present that one of the last parts of the brain to deteriorate will be the hypothalamus, which is responsible for body temperature.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, if somebody is trying to tell you the patient is brain dead and the body is warm, he's got to explain how the hypothalamus is functioning since it's part of the brain. What they'll do is turn around and say, well, that's not reversible. Doesn't matter. The brain is functioning. The reason that's so important is because California and many other states have an act which says if, in the opinion of a doctor or two doctors, that the brain is has irreversibly lost all of its function, then the patient must be pronounced dead. So what I'm suggesting to the doctors is that they can use this fact that the hypothalamus is still functioning as evidence that the brain has not lost all of its functioning. And therefore, if the body is warm, the patient can still be declared alive. Also, it should be noted that one of the provisions in the California Death Act is that nothing in the act is to be construed as preventing a physician from using customary means for determining death. which upset some people when I brought that up. But it's part of the act. In other words, I take that to mean that if a physician wants to, he can use his customary criteria that have always been used, such as heart and respiratory activity, although I don't know if a physician would want to use that halachically or not.
I think to give more credibility to the fact that this whole area is, you know, really confusing, and that we should resuscitate Rabbi Newman more than anybody. He's a baseball fan. Tony Conigliaro. Conigliaro, famous baseball player in Boston, years ago had a massive heart attack and had a flat electroencephalogram. And after 3 months, he is beginning to wake up. As you know, Ruben,
a flat electroencephalogram is meaningless. Everybody knows that. What about the other criteria? Were those present too?
He was essentially dead.
What do you mean essentially?
According
dead?
To their definition,
illicitable reflexes.
Had
he had a respirator.
He was on a respirator. Yeah. He had no spontaneous respiration. Pupils did not react. Hmm. No areflexic. All he had was a heartbeat.
And no response to stimuli?
No response to any stimuli.
Did they do radioactive isotope testing?
I don't know that.
I have in the first footnote to my article on neurological criteria of death, I have a list of articles in medical journals reporting instances of patients who have recovered after having flat EEGs plus some of the others. Now, the reaction that I've gotten from neurologists in New York is that most of these were in European hospitals, and they in effect said that the people who did these tests must have been schlemazels. They don't know how to do the tests.
Which test?
EEG, etc.
In other words, it wasn't.
Yeah, another way to dismiss it. You know, that's what you do in medicine, isn't it? If you have data that conflicts with the results that you want, you ignore it. You say it's irrelevant, it's a fluke, something's wrong. I'm not in the position to argue, primarily because it doesn't make much difference as far as I'm concerned. I'm perfectly willing to concede all the facts to the Harvard Committee, and even conceding the facts, the halacha isn't going to change. So that I don't really think that whether or not you can point to a patient who has survived a so-called irreversible coma is of terribly significance. It's a terribly great significance in terms of all.
How warm is warm?
Since body heat isn't a criterion of halacha, I'm not terribly concerned. I think that's it's a good way to explain it to laymen. But in terms of halacha, if as long as you have either spontaneous respiration or spontaneous cardiac activity, you have a living patient.
So the flat EEGs are meaningless.
It's meaningless. It's meaningless.
You shouldn't even bother doing it.
Well, if you want to do it for medical reasons, fine. But not to pronounce the patient dead.
No, the
Again, let me say like in a hypothetical situation where the heart has stopped beating and respiration has ceased, but you still have an EEG, is the patient alive or not? Rebaron Soloveitchik says that patient's alive. I've never met such a patient. That's why it's easy for me to disagree with him. I think that if you will show me a patient who doesn't have a heartbeat and doesn't have respiration, but does have an EEG, I think he's dead. But I won't argue too hard.
We can give him a heartbeat. And
no, that's...
Give him respiration.
Well, can you give him a spontaneous heartbeat? If you can resuscitate irreversible, remember before, you need an irreversible cessation. If you can reverse the process, the patient's still alive.
The use of doing the EEG is to see if it's if there is activity.
Right,
if there is activity, clinically, definitely doesn't have brain death. But the EEG
once
only
you've got an EEG, then you know that the resuscitation makes sense in those areas.
Right, but the EEG only measures surface dendritic activity. It doesn't say anything about brainstem activity. It doesn't say a lot of other things. And therefore, since that doesn't prove that there is no brain function if it's flat. Rabbi Feynman.
It seems that according to Aloha, if you have a feather put in the needle nose, no movement, or you put a spiegel on a mirror, that's not according to Aloha, the person. Right?
Therefore?
Okay, but it seems to me that what happens if he cannot breathe on his own,
there's
no movement, but through a machine he will be able to breathe.
Right.
And maybe after a while, maybe he will regain. According to Aloha, it was dead already.
Let's start back. You never use a mirror to pronounce a patient dead when you feel a pulse.
There's no defect.
Ah, if there is a heartbeat, the defect's not important. The defect means that the heart is beating.
What is defect? Right?
Defect is a heart. It's a pulse. Right? If the heart is beating, then the fact that you haven't gotten water vapor as a result of exhaling on a mirror doesn't mean the patient is dead. You look for...
He's not breathing. I mean, by the feather, you can see that the guy is not breathing.
So he's not breathing. So what? He can be alive even if he's not breathing, at least for a few moments. As long as there is a defect, you've got a pulse, which means the heart is beating, the patient's still alive. Now, if you have a patient that's alive, and you can put the patient on a respirator, and the heart will keep on beating, you have an obligation to do that. The reductio ad absurdum, if that weren't the case, then every polio victim, thank heavens there aren't terribly many around, but the polio victims who were sustained in iron lungs were dead. Would anybody argue that an iron lung patient is dead? An iron lung patient can't breathe. The machine is breathing for him. It's a respirator. It's doing his breathing for him. What is the criterion of life in that patient? The criterion is the heartbeat. Only that he's relatively healthy, so that in addition to a heartbeat, he's able to talk, he's able to do all kinds of other things. And a patient who is comatose can't do all those other things. But those other things aren't crucial to life.
If he stopped breathing, his heart stopped, he can resuscitate.
Yes. He's alive.
Yes.
Huh? He's alive. Yes. If you can resuscitate, you have to resuscitate.
But He cannot breathe.
He has a heart to stop.
Right.
One of two things. Either the patient is alive, or the doctor who resuscitates, even though he has no obligation to do so, is being Makai Mason. Now, I don't think that doctor... He's resurrecting the dead. Since doctors aren't resurrecting the dead, then if they do manage to resuscitate, this must be a sure indication that the patient wasn't dead in the first place.
Right. Sooner or later, your efforts are going to fail.
Correct.
Which shows it's not you that's doing it, it's God that's doing it, you know.
Baruch determines this human is dead. Right now he's dead.
Right? No, he's not dead. Not at all.
That's where you
I won't know whether he is dead. Look, Halacha says that if a patient stops breathing and the heart stops beating, I can't move him for 20 minutes, half an hour, depending upon which offering you look at. The halacha says that if the patient has stopped breathing, there's no heartbeat, and the patient happens to be pregnant, I cannot take a knife and open the abdomen to remove the fetus because I may be killing the mother, because the mother may still be alive, even though I cannot detect signs of life. What does it mean? It means that the absence of a heartbeat and the absence of respiration are the criteria of death, provided that the patient stays without a heartbeat and the patient stays without breathing. There is this period of time, limited though it may be, 20 minutes, half hour, whatever it is, in which you do not know whether the patient is going to start again. The Chevra Kedisha takes the mirror and then comes back a half hour afterward with the mirror again. If in the half hour the patient hasn't started breathing again, then you say retroactively he must have been dead the first time. But you have to wait in order to confirm the clinical findings. If during that period you can restore a heartbeat or you can restore pulmonary activity, then the patient is very much alive. That's all the doctor is doing when the doctor resuscitates. If the resuscitation fails, then you know the patient was dead earlier. If the resuscitation succeeds, it's not kfiyas ha-mason. You haven't resurrected a dead corpse, but you have simply given therapy to a patient who was very sick before and would have died had you not given him the therapy, but who wasn't dead yet.
Allopathic medicine confuses people for one thing here. Excuse me.
Holopathic medicine?
Well, whatever.
It's almost a contradiction in terms, isn't it? Yeah.
There are cases now where, let's say, that there is no brain waves,
mm-hmm.
no EEG at all. The patient is being resuscitated and given... taking blood gases in order to correct whatever it takes to keep the patient's heart beating. Young patient, only for the reason to pull that plug in case of a good donor for a kidney or something.
Right.
You see. Now this is done every day and done in many hospitals, and you tell me that patient, you can't pull that plug? Well, how do they do it? I can't understand that. I mean, they're doing it.
You know, they haven't come to ask me whether they should do it or not.
But they are doing it.
We asked Dr. Dower about kidney transplants. As I understood it, at least a while back, they could use a kidney from a cadaver if it was, let's say, within 45 minutes of death. Do they have to remove the kidneys from a patient with a heartbeat, or can it be done after the heart has ceased functioning for a while? Because the whole question arises about donating organs and so forth and so on. And, for example, in California, you can just put on the back of your driver's license all the organs you want to donate.
Right.
And the question, and usually, because of what Dr. Dower just said, if Dr. Dower says, you can bet your boots that a physician is going to try to get the kidneys while the patient still has a heartbeat. So anybody who's putting that on his driver's license is probably asking to be murdered, is that right?
The organ really needs to be harvested
while the patient's alive.
Even the corneas?
The chance of success in the transplant is very remote.
Right. Even the corneas?
The patient's not alive. The patient has been pronounced dead, but the patient is alive.
The fact he's been pronounced is meaningless.
Well, look at
the They're all said he's alive. The doctor signed a death certificate. Who cares?
If you want to look at something even more, the heartbeat. Take the example of a heart transplant. Can't do it when the heart stops.
Yes, of course. You've got to remove the heart before it stops beating. Now, look, that's the whole point.
What about the cornea? Can you donate your corneas to a bank? Can an ophthalmologist use those corneas?
Again, let me just make one revision in the question. You'd be surprised how many tshuvas have been written with regard to procedures that don't exist. The tshuvas on cornea transplants are a typical case in point. Tshuvas dealing with prostate surgery are another case in point. There are a number of tshuvas dealing with cornea transplants, analyzing the nature of corneal tissue, the fact that it doesn't have a blood supply, and therefore maybe it's like a nail, like a hair, what have you. The person writing wasn't told that you don't remove a cornea without removing the eye. In point of fact, you remove the eye from the cadaver in order to get the cornea. Now, that's comes a horse of another color. In terms of the bottom line of halacha, a corneal transplant is permissible for pikuach nefesh and for nothing less than pikuach nefesh, because you are dealing with an eye extraction from the cadaver, not just a corneal extraction. You've harvested the whole eye, even though you only need the corneal tissue.
Where's the pikuach nefesh?
Oh, one second. Now, where's the pikuach nefesh? The pikuach nefesh exists only in cases of bilateral blindness. Halacha views bilateral blindness as sakana, by definition. A blind person is at risk for many, many things. Therefore, if you've got a person who is bilaterally blind and needs a corneal transplant, by all means, nevel ames, the violation of the corpse, is permissible to save a life. This is tantamount to saving a life. You can do it, provided that the patient has been dead in accordance with criteria of halacha. And as far as corneal transplants are concerned, the situation is happier than heart surgery or than heart transplants or even renal transplants. You can harvest the cornea with success in transplantation, even if you wait for the patient to be dead in accordance with halacha. Jewish patient, yes.
But what are we saying about kidney transplants then?
With kidney transplants, I'm saying two things. Theoretically, you certainly can harvest a kidney from a patient who has already expired for purposes of transplanting it to a Jewish patient. However, you cannot pronounce the patient dead on the basis of brain death criteria in order to remove the kidney, nor do you have a right, if the patient is a geisus, to perfuse the patient and to wheel him into the operating theater in order to prepare him for harvesting the organ. All those procedures are not warranted if they increase the risk to the patient. If the patient is already a geisus, then by definition this increases the risk. What it means then is, theoretically, you would have to wait until the patient has died and then harvest the kidney, and if it will be advantageous medically, then by all means do so. If at that point it's useless medically, then it's a useless procedure and you have no business doing it.
Okay.
But in other words, the fact that this increases the chance of the recipient surviving by taking the kidney out earlier while it's being perfused,
no, you have no right. You have no right to hasten the death of any person to save the life of somebody else. Again, I got a letter recently from somebody in Eretz Yisrael who discovered America literally. He discovered that they're done as a matter of course in Eretz Yisrael, renal transplants. He discovered that they harvest the kidney before the patient has died. And he's writing me this momentous news that I, of course, don't know about. And he's asking me, why don't I publicize this so that people will not accept kidney transplants? And all I can do is shrug my shoulders. There's a world of difference between harvesting the kidney in the first place and using the kidney once it's been harvested. Once the kidney is available, if this patient doesn't accept, it's going to go to another patient. And if this patient says in advance, I'm not going to accept it, that doesn't mean that they're not going to harvest the patient. They'll simply harvest it for patient number two. I see absolutely no reason to hesitate in using the kidney when the kidney is available.
But halakhically,
No. Again, I'm separating the issues very carefully. You should not be a party to removing the kidney from a living patient. Once the kidney has been removed, by all means, grab it with alacrity in order to save the life of a patient who needs it.
Well, one hand feeds the other.
No. One hand doesn't feed the other. One hand doesn't feed the other.
But in terms of what you were saying of the moral climate of the country, if it's known that...
it's very nice to stand on principles and theories and to educate the public, but you don't educate the public at the expense of lives. It's one thing to say don't dispense birth control pills because you want to create a climate of opinion in which people don't resort to birth control. But it's quite another thing to allow some Jewish patient to die because you're trying to make a point in terms of public policy. By all means, scream as loud as you can about brain death criteria not being acceptable. But once the patient has been taken off the respirator and the patient is dead by all criteria, and once the kidney has already been removed, it doesn't mean that you've got to take the kidney and throw it out the window. Halacha doesn't know of a Miranda principle. And I think that it's important, and that should be part of the public stance. Look, you guys, I don't like what you're doing in terms of harvesting the kidneys, but I'm not a fool. You've got the kidney, by all means, once it's there, use it. You shouldn't have taken it in the first place, but once you've taken it, it's got to be used.
What about a live donor kidney?
I see no problem with a live kidney donors, provided that the donor is aware of the risk, minimals. I humbly beg to differ.
Is there an obligation for people to donate blood when there is a blood drive?
Donate blood when there is a blood drive.
As opposed to having a specific patient in front of you that needs your blood and...
When there's a patient who needs your blood, I think there's an absolute obligation.
Even if he's not Jewish?
Well, again, when it's Jewish, there's an absolute obligation. I don't think that you should make distinctions between Jews and non-Jews, particularly with regard to donating blood. And if your non-Jewish neighbor asks for some blood, I think you should give it. Now, I'm saying that because it seems to me that donating blood involves no real risk. Again, I do know that there is some minimal risk of hepatitis. I don't think it's significant. I think that those risks are in the category of shem ripsoyim. Therefore, you cannot plead that there is a risk involved. There's a tshuva in the Radvaz who talks about the loss of blood through a scratch in the ear as being potentially life-threatening in nature. I don't think that under contemporary medical and scientific conditions, there's any danger involved. Therefore, I think when there's a chilul lefaneinu, there's an obligation to donate blood. When there is no patient here and now requiring the blood, there is no absolute imperative, but it's certainly a very good idea, and it's a mitzvah to provide it, but it doesn't mean that it's mandatory. Yes? Yes, but I think you should do it. And not just you can't. Yeah, I think it's a very good idea for there to be blood banks.
Right.
I think it's a very good idea to create a climate of opinion in which people donate blood to blood banks. Therefore, Jews should donate blood to blood banks. Now that's public policy. That doesn't mean that you have a halacha to go down to the blood bank every month and to donate a pint of blood. But when there is a blood campaign, I think that we should participate to the fullest extent.
Right.
Are not this distinction between Jew and Gentile by what the seven commandments given to Noah, are not Gentiles committed to preserving, they can't take life, right?
They can't take life, but they don't necessarily have an obligation to preserve life. So that was last night's discussion.
Rabbi Berkowitz.
I just want to ask, this is kind of on the side. Thing, you know, Shvich is done. There's no Shiloh about just giving blood.
Chavola.
Huh?
It's Chavola, not Shvich is done. Chavola, wounding. Wounding for therapeutic purposes is permissible.
Even if there's no definite chayla in front of you.
Even if there is no chayla b'fonenu, where it is constructive rather than destructive, the bottom line is that it's mutter.
Yeah.
Okay. I think this sort of.
Can we discuss what the criteria?
The criteria of death. Well,
do we want to break from Myra? I'm gonna be glad to talk some more about the criteria of death if necessary.
Okay. Well, I think we should summarize. In other words, what you're saying is, you would agree that if the body is warm, the patient is alive?
Yes, I think that's a good rule of thumb. If you want a clear, precise definition, a patient is dead only when there is irreversible cessation of a cardiac and respiratory function.
Irreversible.
The only way to tell if it's irreversible is by trying to reverse it.
Well, again, you may not be obligated to try to reverse it in all cases.
Remember my
95-year-old man with two cardiac arrests?
Because the 95-year-old man is a ghost.
It was a ghost, definitely. Otherwise, you have an absolute obligation to try to reverse it. That's absolutely correct, but that doesn't mean that you should not encourage the non-Jewish doctor to preserve life. Remember, goyim can also perform mitzvahs, and they get schar for it too. And they get rewarded for doing mitzvahs, and they get rewarded for saving life, particularly Jewish life. I think they get schar for preserving non-Jewish life also, but that's debatable, so we won't talk about it. But I certainly think that they ought to be encouraged to preserve life to the fullest extent possible.
What does preserve mean in this situation?
Preserve or prolong.
You're talking about resuscitation, or are we talking about...
Well, no, we're talking generally. That was a very broad question with regard... That was as if we had a non-Jewish physician who's saying, maybe my obligations aren't as great as the obligations of a Jewish physician. And the answer is, of course they're not. But we're not talking to non-Jewish physicians, and when we do talk to non-Jewish physicians, I think it's important to tell them that non-Jews may also perform mitzvahs, even if they are not mandated to do so.
But are we saying that we could issue a different... a more lenient set of criteria to these physicians of pulling a plug or something like that?
No, not pulling a plug, giving penicillin injections and things of that sort, which doesn't involve an act of homicide. In other words, remember last night I said that the goyim have managed to assimilate a great deal of the Sheva mitzvahs in one form or another, and I think I said that the code of ethics of the AMA is perfect halacha for non-Jews. A physician may choose whom he shall treat. A non-Jew doesn't have a mitzvah v'sam elam riach. He doesn't have to save a life. He's busy, wants to go to the golf course. He doesn't have to stop at the scene of an accident. A Jewish physician does have an obligation to stop at the scene of an accident. It's a good code of ethics for non-Jews, but not for Jews. That's in terms of bottom line halacha. The non-Jew who stops and treats the accident victim has fulfilled a mitzvah. He'll get reward for it. And he certainly should be encouraged to do so. In every way possible.
Dr. Wallen.
I still have, I just want to clarify a little bit about what we said about the the code versus no code questions.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Basically, if a physician could diagnose a ghosis, then the halacha is clear.
Yeah, incidentally, I probably should have added that earlier. I don't think there are many such animals around today as a ghosis. Now, that may sound surprising, but I don't think it really is. The ghosis is clearly a relative concept, particularly if you talk about surviving after therapy. what would survive after therapy in one age will not survive after therapy in another age. Now, let me make one other point, and that is, again, technical terms that I cannot define precisely, a treif. There's a treif, everybody knows what treif means, non-kosher meat. Non-kosher meat is treif. The word basically doesn't mean non-kosher, but it means the flesh of an animal that has suffered from a certain set of clearly defined abnormalities or trauma. Rule of thumb, a traumatic injury or congenital defect such that the animal will not survive for 12 months. That's nothing more than a rough rule of thumb. They're clearly defined. That's what Hilchos Treifos is all about in Yuraday. Now, there is a similar concept with regard to human beings. Only as far as human beings are concerned, the application is very limited since we're not cannibals. If we were cannibals, we wouldn't be able to eat the flesh of humans who are treifos. But if you commit an act of homicide and the victim was a treif, it's not a capital crime. It doesn't mean you go around killing these people, but you won't be executed for doing so. Now, how do you define a treif?
That's halacha.
It's halacha, yeah. It's
not. Could you repeat that, Rabbi?
If you
there's an opinion that says that human treif is not the same as animal.
Wait a minute. That's the point. The halacha is that if you commit an act of homicide and the victim was suffering from one of these traumatic accidents or one of these congenital defects, you will not be executed for having done it. We won't give you maftar and Shabbos either, but we won't execute you for having done this. It's non-capital homicide, it's manslaughter. Okay, now, here, the Gemara defines treifus for human beings and treifus for animals, and this rule of thumb is nothing more than the rule of thumb. You've got it spelled out in all the gory clinical details. Comes along the Rambam, and the Rambam codifies the halacha for animals, and when it comes to humans, he says that a treif is whatever the doctor says won't survive 12 months. The treif of a human being is different from the treif of an animal. The sources aren't important. What the Rambam is saying is that the halacha for animals became ossified at Har Sinai. Those animals didn't survive for 12 months, and that's a treif forever and ever, and don't call them a veterinarian. When you're dealing with a human being, you're not dealing with a stagnant halacha. Those were the treifos of a certain period in history. In other periods of history, you may be able to cure this abnormality and the guy's not a treif anymore. Therefore, the definition of treif, insofar as a human being is concerned, changes with the historical epoch and medical wisdom. Now, if the definition of treif is subject to change, it's not surprising to me that the definition of a geisus is subject to change. Why? Because geisus is even more elastic than treif. What's a geisus? A geisus is a patient who is in the state of dying. What does it mean, the patient in the state of dying? It means the Malach HaMoves has started working. The angel of death is here. If the angel of death is here, he's a geisus. Now, there are times when you can interfere with the angel of death. He's in the room, you can take him by the scruff of the neck and you throw him out. Come back some other time, maybe 10 years from now, 20 years from now, maybe a week from now, but in the meantime you've thrown him out. Our knowledge of angelology changes. Sometimes we don't know how to get a hold of this Malach HaMoves. Other times we've got pliers and pincers and tweezers and all kinds of electrical gadgets that catch the Malach and take him and throw him out the door. Now, whenever you can, the principle is that if you can't throw him out, you leave him alone. You don't start up with a Malach unless you know you're going to win. And when you know you're going to win, then you start up. If you know you can throw him out, you've got to throw him out. If you're not going to be able to throw him out, then you leave him alone. You don't have to, or at least you're not obligated to start up with a Malach. That's a different kind of a principle. So that at one period in history, we didn't know how to deal with a patient presenting a certain clinical profile. It meant, in effect, that we didn't know how to catch the Malach HaMoves in the net and throw him out the door. If you've now learned how to throw him out the door, then you're obligated to throw him out the door. And the definition of geisus then is relative and subject to change. And we've reached the stage where the Malach HaMoves, he's got to work very fast in order to succeed. And when he malingers a little bit, it's very easy to throw him out. Therefore, you've got an obligation to throw him out.
I think if there are no further questions on this subject, we could break from Myrav and there are some pastries, and then maybe we could continue with some of the rest of the, trying to finish the rest of the questions.
Can I have them in the next room? Yeah.
Yeah, why don't we put the pastries in... The next question concerns yichud in the office or the examining room.
My office has many problems. In your office, you have problems there.
Was that your question? Was that your question? Could you elaborate on that? What problems do you perceive?
Whatever you do has to be done. That's not good.
There's no calories in this one.
Try to remember.
Okay, Dr. Waldman is going to explain exactly what problems he's envisioning in terms of yichud.
Are there problems with yichud closing the door, being in a room, whether the office, whether the examining room? I don't know if it makes a difference.
It doesn't make a difference. Office, examining room. I understand there are some people who are matir yichud for a physician on the basis of various svaras, but I don't think that's normative. I don't think it's accepted. I think you should be careful with regard to yichud. It's in general, it's not that hard. First of all, I'm told that it's good medical practice for a male physician never to examine a female patient without a nurse present. They tell me that that's called preventive.
That's usually done only when it's a pelvic examination, though.
That's true enough, yes.
Although the halacha, would it make
Wouldn't make any difference. It wouldn't make any difference. But the simple way to remove the problems of yichud in normal office practice is to make it very clear that you don't mind being interrupted for serious matters, which means that the nurse will come in if there's anything requiring your attention. And in those circumstances, as long as the door's not locked, there's no problem with the yichud.
The door can be closed,
but the nurse outside has entree at all times.
What if it's the nurse's custom to knock first? That doesn't make a difference.
It might. I think you should tell the nurse to come in without knocking.
Although, practically speaking, then there is a problem. Because,
no,
for example,
it's modified. It's easily resolved. It's easily resolved. If you don't want to leave the door open, simply tell the nurse that when there's important business, to come in without knocking, not to bother knocking.
No, but I'm saying that practically, that would pose a problem itself. If I'm examining a male patient,
yeah,
I don't necessarily want the nurse to barge in.
Don't worry about it. I wouldn't worry about it.
You have a little curtain.
No, not an exam room. What happens usually is I hear the knock, I put the sheet over, I go to the door, I open up, and then I let the nurse in. That's the usual way it happens, practically. But it's a matter of tznius.
In order to avoid yichud, I would not be concerned about tznius. Particularly when you have a sheet available anytime, when you hear the door opening, you'll cover the mail.
That was one of the questions we had about the paramedical, paraprofessional personnel. Was there any problem with tznius regarding that? Or, in other words, if they're doing their professional job, they're considered the same
category? No, there's no halacha that says only a doctor is allowed to treat a patient. If a paraprofessional is performing professional duties, then the paraprofessional is a reife. He may not be a doctor, but he's a reife. He's got the same category. Yes?
Is there any restriction about a male doctor, treating a female patient?
He's busy doing his job, and assuming that he is a proper, upstanding individual to start with, he's going to do his job and nothing else, not be affected thereby.
What about the lady patient going to a non-Jewish doctor, male?
There's no difference between a Jew and a non-Jewish.
No, no, no. A Jewish lady patient.
Right,
Is she concerned about these things or not?
Which things? Tznius.
Yeah. Tznius.
What difference is yichud is a problem? But again, it shouldn't be a serious problem in most cases. particularly when she goes to a female gynecologist, to a male gynecologist who doesn't examine her unless there's a nurse present anyway.
Who goes to an hospital happens to be in that hospital, the standard procedure is the doctor does not need the nurse present at the same time.
In a hospital is very seldom a problem with yichud. People are always opening doors about not
being
in hospitals.
Nurses usually will not step
in a hospital. We're talking about an office in the hospital, we're talking about a hospital.
A clinic.
Most hospitals that I know, the clinic is literally a yurid.
The patient is being
in the room. I don't know.
Is there an obligation on not having yichud for a woman?
Oh yes, same thing. There's no problem.
So does she have any problem leaving the door open if she's disrobed, because to avoid yichud?
Many places you maintain that when the door isn't locked, there's no yichud. B, under those circumstances, I think she should leave it ajar slightly. If you leave it ajar slightly, so you satisfy all problems. Nobody can look in, and B, it's not closed.
Is the wife included to ask the doctor to leave the door ajar slightly? If my wife closes
the door,
open.
My impression is, at least the doctor's offices I visited, I have never seen a problem with yichud, because every examining room that I've been in has been an examining room with the interruptions constantly.
And also,
that's been my experience. You people seem to be practicing a higher form of etiquette.
California.
And also, physicians don't lock themselves in a room with a patient unless the nurse is present and it's a pelvic exam or some very special thing. The doors are never locked in the examining rooms. They're just open and...
Yeah, I understand. Doors are certainly
not. Is there any type of examination that usually they do? They do say, another one, no interruption whatsoever, and they close the door?
But those are typically examinations, like a pelvic examination, where a nurse is present in the room before the door is locked.
How does it happen at Bitin? If there's two women in the same room,
the door shouldn't be locked. You shouldn't lock the door.
But if there's not going to be, the door is closed,
right,
and there's nobody but the nurse,
right,
and nobody will bother besides the nurse, right, is there yichud anyway?
Yes, depending upon whether or not the closed door without a lock constitutes yichud. Now, under those circumstances, if they've got a nurse present, and usually there's more than just nurse floating around the office, there are other people who could come in at any time. When you have other people who come in at any time, most people.
No, it's the nurse and the doctor too.
No. It's usually more than that.
Other people.
Receptionists.
You got all kinds of people floating around.
Is the number of people crucial here, or is it why is this still yichud with another person in the room?
Two women is also yichud.
So how about three women?
You're not going to call in another patient.
Two nurses. You could have two nurses.
Yes, but you don't want to waste the time of two nurses during every pelvic examination.
Of course.
Only pelvic examination likely to take some time. The doctor doesn't want to waste the time of two employees when the first one is superfluous, let alone the second. But there are two simple expedients. One, to let the people outside know that they can come in without knocking, and we'll drape the patient as the door opens if necessary. And B, to leave the door ajar slightly, even without leaving it open.
We're not asking from the point of view of the doctor, we're asking from the point of view
of the patients.
Our husband's a patient,
Right.
My wife goes to a gynecologist.
Let her ask them to leave the door ajar slightly.
She should do that.
Yeah.
What about the fact that our husband is in town? That doesn't help.
When there is bailu b'ir, that's another tzad to be made. When the husband is
in the house, bailu b'ir is not going to just.
That's why I said it's only
the hospital open all the doors.
That's why I said it's only a tzad to be made. It's not absolute. The question is whether the husband would march into the room or whether he would be intimidated by the doctor. There's some people, for some strange reason, are intimidated by doctors. And they won't barge into his examining room. But there are others who would maintain that the concept of bailu b'ir applies as much in the doctor's office as it applies in somebody else's living room. if he'll barge into somebody else's living room, he'll barge into the doctor's office also. Why shouldn't he? He's more welcome in the doctor's examining room than somebody else's living room.
Sure. Again, we go to that, he has permission. He would just open the door.
Depends he has the permission to go into someone else's house and go into a doctor's office.
The but you know, I think the problem is easily avoided without making a big deal out of it.
By leaving the door slightly open.
I had a dream. Somebody from Guinea was screaming.
Yes, I'm aware. I'm aware of the screaming on both sides. There's those who are screaming that it's awesome. There's those who are screaming that they don't know what they're talking about. The comments doesn't even make all, including all the reasons that you've cited. And it seems to me it's a big to-do about a problem that can easily be obviated. You can eliminate the problem totally and completely.
It's true, you might not have what to scream about, but there's another thing. The fact is, the lady comes into the doctor's office, she will feel uncomfortable asking to leave the door ajar, and okay, let's say if she's concerned about you, but let her forget her discomfort. Many doctors will say, what do you mean leave the door ajar? To them, it just... In other words, I'm talking about a mensch, I'm not talking about a grubby woman. You know, some of them just can't relate to that concept. What do you mean, leave the doors slightly ajar?
Religious requirement. They understand it very well. They're worried about lawsuits.
If the door is slightly ajar, then people can knock. Then there's no problem.
Yes, once it's ajar, you don't have yichud by definition. So whoever they want.
Can I go to the next one?
But there is nobody walking there. There is no.
In an office,
the doctor has an office in his house. And his wife is not there.
Yes. You can have a patient in the house, and you can be a doctor who doesn't have very many patients. You have only one patient the whole day, and you've got this woman coming to visit you, and you're examining her in the back room of your house. The door jar is going
to help.
We're talking to successful doctors. They don't practice that kind of medicine. They practice in offices where there's traffic, the people coming, the people going.
It's a known fact in New York. There are many, many doctors.
Where is this, Argentina?
Go to New York.
Are you finding something different about the house office? Is that it?
Yes,
the question?
Yes.
The house office?
Yeah, he is finding something different.
You have a house.
What's wrong in the house? You have a maid in the house. You leave the door open, right?
He's implying that there are some doctors who can't afford maids, and they don't have very many patients, and they can have an office out in the back porch someplace, and they have only one patient a day, and this patient comes in, he's examining her in the back room. It won't help to leave the door ajar if the front door is locked. Now, leaving the door from the pantry into the kitchen isn't going to make... Of course! I mean, but these people know that. Now, we're talking about the normal situation where there is...
Tell you
my for good medical reasons.
Whatever, let's say, not the like doctor. A person has a maid in the house, and the wife went away. Can you stay in the house?
She asked you, Shiloh, about
yichud. We're talking about yichud
already. Yeah, no, well, what's that got to do? It doesn't do with doctors, of course not. Okay, you don't stay in the house with a maid when your wife goes away.
You can stay. I thought if you left the front door open, or if you...
You mean you're leaving the doors open?
Yeah, or if your wife is in town and there's not...
No, your wife in town doesn't work. It doesn't work the other way. Or you stay in the front room if it's a busy street and you leave the shades open. Of course, I mean, those are the ways to get around the problem. Mm-hmm. But there is a problem of yichud with maids. Mm-hmm. Good, so you have to resolve the problems of yichud.
Define a door ajar.
Yes.
Could be just that it's actually closed, except that the little
passerby
hasn't clicked.
The passerby in the hall recognizes that this is not a closed door but an open door. An open door means you go in. A closed door means you don't go in. When the door is ajar, it's open, by definition.
Even if you can't see,
you don't have to see. You don't have to be able to see into the room. As long as it's clear that the door is open, not closed.
As long as it's not clicked, as long as you can see it's not closed, I don't see those as being the same. When it's just not clicked, doesn't necessarily appear to be that it's not closed.
Precisely, that's why I said it has to be perceivable by the passerby as an open door rather than as a closed door.
If we could just... Dr. Waltman has one last point on this question, and we'll get to the next question.
I want to know how to practice tomorrow.
Yeah.
Please. As long as we are liable to be interrupted by
who?
three women, two women, one woman, a male, who?
As long as the people in the office know that they are at liberty to march into the room, there's no yichud.
Even if there's only one other nurse around in the whole area?
Even if there is only one
So there's only you and one nurse in the area?
Who could delegate in somebody else to come in as well. In other words, as long as it's known that this door can be opened by anybody who has business in that room, anybody, you know, obviously, you're not going to send the mailman in there. But anybody who wants to get into that room would be able to get into that room without having your head handed there on a silver platter. And under those circumstances, there's no yichud by definition.
Even if there's only one nurse around at that particular moment.
Right. And you would tell that nurse, you can send anybody else in who has to come in.
Is there any time limit on how long the door could be locked, closed?
Under the
Under those circumstances, it would be closed.
No, under any regular circumstances.
No. You say, you're thinking two different questions. Under regular circumstances, to all intents and purposes, there's no time limit.
In other words, if the patient clicks the door closed as she walks in, you're in trouble already?
You open it immediately.
But you haven't done an area yet?
No, of course. But the time limit would be so brief that you couldn't do any meaningful medical business during that time anyway. So, in other words, when the patient just click the door closed, so you open the door. But you're not going to be able to close it long enough to do any procedure.
I mean, there are times people walking by in the hall notice the door is open and close it, and not even realize it.
The lady happens to be in and the door's locked. What do you do?
What do you do?
You keep
someone in the office that they can walk in if they need.
I think the best thing is to hire a sign on the door. Please enter.
By the time you get out of the elevator, it's honest, the elevator goes 1 mile for 3 hours. The elevator is not enough time.
An elevator.
The door's open. Is there a
Most people don't perceive a shallow elevator.
Because of this short time span?
The short time span between floors. The time span between floors is extremely short. And at any floor, the door can be opened. People have permission to enter at every floor.
Most people feel there's no shaylon.
But if you're a woman, you don't go in when there's a strange-looking man in an elevator.
That's nothing to do with yichud.
No,
that's called safety.
What if you're
already? Well, the next right there.
Okay, next question is, although I feel comfortable patting a patient on the back or touching him in the course of comforting him, I am unsure whether I may shake a woman's hand, the patient herself, relatives of the patient, Gentile versus Jewish woman, to avoid embarrassment for that woman by my refusing. In other words...
Why don't you shake hands with patients? Female patients.
At the end of an exam many times, or isn't any woman may...
Thank you, doctor.
Socially, in a sense, want to shake your hand. Is that
a handshaking question. All right.
It's the same thing that happens to rabbis in this...
All the time. Rabbis have more shots.
It's the same thing that happens when
right. Businessmen have this... Right.
And then they're so thankful and they stretch out.
Businessmen have this,
When you're doing a professional, examination,
The reason this is unique to doctors is you've just finished doing a pelvic exam and now you're going to tell the woman you can't shake her hand. That's what the question is.
Are you suggesting the rabbis surmount the question by performing pelvic exams?
That's right, that's a point.
Let me try to answer the question. There are clearly oisrim, people who forbid shaking hands with a woman, with a woman. By the same token, it seems to me that the position of the matirim is extremely cogent. Those who permit is extremely cogent. In some circles, in my old age, I heard of a new iser in some circles in New York, not circles that are associated with chumras. It's called negiya. Negi is usher. It took me a while to understand what they meant. Negi means touching. I don't know of an isser of negiya. The isser that I know about is called chibuk v'nishuk. petting, caressing, etc. That's the yisra. Tactile contact, which is the dictionary definition of petting, is not osur. Now, the question is, what's a handshake? Is a handshake a caress, or is a handshake innocent tactile contact? There, again, the I don't know of any matirim in print, but I do know individuals who have stated rather publicly that they maintained that there was no prohibition against shaking hands with a woman. That's a normal form of social contact without any erotic connotations. They tell me that Reb Shimon Shkop, when he was in America, in Europe, no woman would have dared give him her hand. But in America, these women extended their hand to him and he shook hands with them. He didn't go around offering his hand to every woman in the street, but when they extended the hand to him, he accepted it. The reasoning seems to me extremely cogent, namely that there is no general prohibition against simply touching, and this isn't chibuk and nishuk the way other forms of contact would be, and therefore there's no reason to embarrass the woman who has extended a hand.
Isn't there such a thing as negiyo derechivo?
Of course, that's
what the whole deal. The purpose chibu, of the handshaking is for chibu.
Well, it's a chibu. Why is it chibu? What makes it chibu?
Well,
the handshake
it's
is
a friend. That's called a friendly shake.
Friendly gesture.
No, it's not. It's not.
No. It, shaking hands. It's a way that people greet friendly to each other.
It means hello.
And they touch in the in a way of friendliness. It's a nice. Right.
Chibu isn't friendly. Chibu is a little bit more than friendly. Friendly means simply I'm not your enemy. You know, I'm doing it as a sign of goodwill, but not as a sign of any kind of emotional involvement. You have absolutely no involvement with the clerk in the store who shakes hands because you've made a large purchase and he's happy that day or whatever. That's not an emotional kind of relationship. And where there's absent all other interest, I don't see that there's a problem.
Something comes automatic.
Huh? Yeah.
No, I will say one thing
the
that...
shaking your head, it's something which is...
That's what they say.
In a society where this is not done, I presume that it would very well be chibur. But in this society, I don't think that it's a sign of chibur.
I will say that I had one... I was treating a non-Jewish psychiatrist. His daughter was a laboratory technician, came to visit him, put out her hand, and I guess automatically, at that time I was starting not to shake hands, basically. But automatically I shook her hand, and I said, I told her I shouldn't have done that. And sure enough, her father's hand became paralyzed the next day. And after I told her I shouldn't have done that, his hand got better.
That's too much.
I agree.
There was a nice story with the Friedrich Rebbe. Once a lady came to see us and stuck her hands to shake him.
Did you know?
And the Friedrich Rebbe felt with a nice smile. My father taught me not to touch something that doesn't belong to me. That was a nice way to.
It makes no difference, Jew or Gentile.
Let's not confuse halacha with standards of Chabad Hasidim. Let's not confuse the ballgame. Rabbi Bleich is talking as halacha. It's clear. If someone's a Lubavitch Hasid, Lubavitch Hasidim don't shake hands. If you're a big Rav and you have Shalas, I know Lubavitch Hasidim that do shake hands. If you have, but you have to know the standard. You don't have to drink Kol Yisrael.
Can you drink Kol Yisrael?
A Lubavitch Chassid doesn't drink.
No, mitzad chumra, mitzad halacha. You're making two alterations now. There's two opinions. There's one opinion which is machmir, which says shaking hands is forbidden midoraisa, if she's neither, which usually she is, and.
Right. Who? Tell me a wife you're talking about?
A lady
in Nidus, Midrash.
Yes, not she's married. She's married. What's the
Gia, the Rechiva, with a Nidus, Midrash also.
Yeah.
No question about it.
Okay.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, it's open and open. Yeah. And there's another opinion which says shaking hands is not the Rechiva with the Shona speaking about. But not by
simple. So that's the issue.
Okay, there's two
opinions. The shaking hands is the Rechiva that we're speaking about.
Okay, but there's two opinions involved. It's not sure. One is Midas Chassidus, one is Aloha.
Yeah.
In the Aloha Gufa, there's two opinions.
I don't know whether two opinions or not. Because if there are two opinions, then there's two opinions about a mitzvah, a point of fact. I suspect that the Machmirim are dealing with not a Midrash Chassid. No, it's not Midrash. The ones who are saying it, the people say Shorei Vayavar, the Mayadim Ismanim, Shtermberg.
We're not talking about those Machmirim.
What those Machmirim? It's more significant to me than the other Machmirim.
The other
I don't take seriously. I suspect that. No, him I take
seriously.
We're not
talking about Machmirim whose Indian and life is the plaster sign.
Moshe Sternberg doesn't plaster science, he just writes for it. He's not one of those, he's not crazy. I suspect that they're dealing with a social situation in society in which it could not be explained any other way. And I think they assume that all over it has a certain connotation which it doesn't necessarily have among all people at all times. I don't know of anybody who holds that Negiya alone, which isn't Derech Hivam, which isn't Chibuk V'Nishuk, should be a Yorik Vayavar. Right? So if I see somebody says handshaking, he must hold it's Chibuk. Now, in my society, I just look outside and I don't see it, unless I don't see things. So I must assume he's talking about other people who have different social practices and a different type of orientation. In other words, I haven't seen any great Lomdish and Machloikis here. I presume they're describing different sets of facts. Now, what the sets of facts, what set of fact pertains in Long Beach, I leave to you.
But the bottom line seems to be you can shake hands the way
I think you can accept the hand of the success.
One second. And you can touch for comfort.
What, in the course of treatment?
Well, that was part of Dr. Tolman's question. In terms of...
I'm more concerned about touching for comfort than accepting a hand of
success. Because sometimes, in caring for male patients that, holding on to touching the shoulder or whatever else to console a patient or to...
I have more problems with that than with a
Yeah, but that's exactly what I want to ask because I have to do this tomorrow.
Why do you have to do it tomorrow?
Your assertion. When I think about shaking hands, I would like to get to a different part. I often will hold a woman's hand as a course of part of examination. And I'm not talking about looking
to make it feel secure, to make it
feel... That's right.
Sure.
To make it feel secure in what way?
I know that if I...
The laying on of hands.
I don't have to give you exactly the particulars. But I know that...
If you don't have to give me the particulars, you shouldn't do it.
Well, I know that if I have a woman who... yesterday she had a mastectomy.
Yes.
And today I have to go and talk to her about it.
Right.
Well, I happen to know that if I can somehow... This woman needs more than me just standing and telling her, that she's got cancer and she's... I feel in my practice, in my experience, that is an integral part of her care, her treatment, for me to hold her hand and tell her. That's my experience and my practice.
It feels as therapeutic.
This is the question.
That I don't think you should do.
Well, I don't know.
You don't think you should do?
No, I don't.
Why isn't it considered
that there are people part of the profession which feels that...
And I guess along the lines of what you were saying before, then we have to go along some other tack to be therapeutic.
Yes, of course.
And
I'm absolutely
what you said before to
sure,
attack
sure,
the
sure.
pain as opposed
yeah,
to...
Yeah, I'm not talking, by no means excluding other forms of therapy.
Right.
But I don't think that...
I think that's a good idea. I have a nurse in the room holding her hand.
Why would this be not allowed since the patient is in danger or whatever?
Because this is clearly emotional contact, whatever the emotion is. I'm not quite sure what the emotion is. But this is being done... But this is being done to depersonalize, not to depersonalize, but to personalize the situation and to deprofessionalize it.
Why do you say deprofessionalize? I think that it's a golden standard that to become so professional that you can offer that degree of comfort.
It's not a mark that he's becoming personal. Let me explain. I think it's very good not to be professional, to be personal. But there are other ways and ways, acceptable ways of being personal, and other ways that aren't entirely acceptable. I would suspect that the tactile contact in this case has a kind of emotional charge. Now, at that point, becomes suspect. It's not just a social handshake.
That's the question. It goes back to the same question. In other words, is part of a doctor's job, just like the doctor's healing the person physically, healing. I mean, I do just the opposite of what I'm suggesting should be done, because I see it. I go to a person's bed, the person is sick, and the person extends a hand, and it happens very often, or the person wants to hold you, or to thank you, and you don't know how to react. Right. And maybe say more than perhaps what my social structure is. The person's social structure is that comforting is holding their hand.
That doesn't mean there.
In other words, Lenny's patient.
Yes, in his case, he is initiating this particular form of therapy. And I think he has the option of doing the same type of therapy other ways.
And if they initiated it?
What if they grabbed?
That's you know, the drowning person trying to hold on to you. That's different, clearly different.
What if?
But that doesn't mean I wouldn't try to disengage before it becomes more than that. I don't think you have to run away as if it were the plague the first second. But I don't think that this type of hand-holding is appropriate as part of the therapy. I think you should try to accomplish the same thing other ways.
What if you find that with your male patients, putting your arm around them and talking to them, touching, you find it a lot more successful than when you deal with your female patients and you stand for
your I suspect, without asking specifically, that doctors tend to do this more with female patients than with male patients. Now, of course, he doesn't break news of a mastectomy to a male patient. But if he breaks...
Because females are more fragile than they
need. Right. Women feel more in need of encouragement.
Please, we all know the difference.
And the ladies hospital, they had an article on touching.
Yes.
And on the healing of touching.
Yes.
And it said during labor, a woman's pain is alleviated at least 50% by touching. Which I found that once I got my labor coats to come down and, you know, held my hand, you could survive it a lot easier than not. Okay? But
I wonder whether an iron bar would have worked just as well.
What?
I wonder whether an iron bar at the grip would have worked just as well.
It did. I had iron bars.
A silver bar.
Mm-hmm. Gold, it's not a person. It's not touch.
Okay, yeah.
But there, I would imagine there are definite values in touching.
Okay, we'll accept there's value. Now the question is whether it's appropriate or whether it's inappropriate. Mm-hmm. And I suspect, A, that this is much more frequent in treating female patients than in male patients, and the very fact that it's that much frequent makes it that much more suspect. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's appropriate. It's the bottom line.
Are you suggesting...
But I think you should do the same thing otherwise.
Suggesting that the... That if it were more frequent with female patients, that would be a sign that...
That would be one indication.
Hmm?
That would be one indication.
That what?
That it's a certain type of contact that's involved here, which is acceptable in our society, but that skirts the borders of certain types of conduct that even in our society isn't acceptable. Look, if I spell things out. Social dancing is a sexual act. It's a sexual act which is acceptable. Other forms of sexual acts are not acceptable in society. If this type of conduct borders on that area, then you understand immediately what the connotations are. I suspect very strongly that it is something very similar which our society condones. That doesn't mean halacha condones it. And I think that it's a clear indication that we're dealing with something which is beyond an innocuous social gesture. Which halacha would do.
So you're saying,
what if the same thing that you know that you would do for male, would you be allowed to go ahead and do that for female?
No. I took this simply as an indicator of what's going on here. You may have a doctor who does it indiscriminately with males and females, and indeed his intentions may be absolutely the purest in nature. But I think that the act, by its very nature, is more than just innocuous social contact. And hence shouldn't be condoned.
Even though it's therapeutic.
Even though it's therapeutic. Look, sexual activity can be extremely therapeutic in some circumstances. That doesn't make it permissible. Yes, there are many psychiatrists who believe that it's an integral part of the therapy. Now, they proceed to practice psychiatry that way. That doesn't mean that it can be condoned.
The kids, sir, a little summary. In other words, you're saying, halakhically now we're talking about, your feeling is that handshakes are permissible?
Yes.
Okay. Your feeling is also clearly that touching a person of the opposite sex, when even though one may think that it's being done to comfort the person.
It is being done to comfort the person, but it's got certain overtones that make it unacceptable.
It is unacceptable.
That's what you're saying.
Yes. Okay, the next.
What about in the nursing care? Is that different?
Nursing care is entirely different. For example, a male nurse with a female patient. That's.